You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an award-winning citizen scientist in Wisconsin about his work tracking the state's butterflies, birds, and robber flies. First, if you're a regular hiker or have been visiting some state parks or trails in the last few months, you may have run into some crowded parking lots or seemingly busier than usual trails. Many seasoned and new hikers have been seeking out some time in nature during the pandemic, especially with other vacation options limited. And the leaves are starting to change colors around the state, with many northern counties expected to hit peak color already next week. Those good views are bound to draw some more people to the woods. But while we're enjoying our hikes, there are some concerns that we're not always taking great care of the trails along the way. Liz Wessel is chair of the local Sierra Club Four Lakes group, as well as a volunteer leader with the Sierra Club John Muir chapter, which focuses statewide on Wisconsin. Liz, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And also with us, Peter Nordgren of Cornucopia, a longtime volunteer with the North Country Trail Association in northern Wisconsin. He volunteers his time with the Brule St. Croix chapter of the trail. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, first, I want to get your reports in your parts of the state. Liz, what are you hearing in South Central Wisconsin when it comes to the numbers of people getting out on the trails?
Well, we're lucky to be in South Central Wisconsin, and we have some of the gems of the state park system, both the trails and parks in our area. And, of course, the parks are super busy and many days overcrowded, I would say. So you think of Devil's Lake and Governor Dodge, and, yeah, we have some pretty crowded days on the trails.
And, Peter, in your trail, on the North Country Trail, are you seeing a lot of people up there this year?
Well, we're a little more distant from population areas, so we aren't seeing the same kinds of crowding as in southern Wisconsin. But the numbers are definitely up. We checked in with Copper Falls State Park and Patterson State Park. The North Country Trail runs through both. And they're saying, yes, numbers are up. And, of course, we keep a little bit of track through such things as register boxes along the trail, and we're seeing more use of the trail at our trailheads.
Peter, Liz mentioned a couple of the gems in South Central Wisconsin. What are a couple of the great spots in your neck of the woods?
Well, here in the Northwest, I would mention particularly the area around Solon Springs. Solon Springs is one of our two official North Country Trail towns, where the trail runs right through. Right outside Solon Springs, we have two things. One is the Brule Bog Boardwalk that takes you through the headwaters of the Brule and St. Croix Rivers, and also the Brule St. Croix Portage Trail. I say that it's probably the oldest trail in the Midwest. The first record of use of it goes back to 1680. A little farther east, of course, people enjoy the trail in the Shawamigan-Nicolay National Forest. And Copper Falls, of course, is one of our gems of state parks in the region, too.
And Liz, you mentioned things getting crowded sometimes at some of the more popular parks you mentioned. How do you see people dealing with this given the COVID pandemic? Obviously, being outside is a good way to get out and enjoy ourselves while we can in the midst of this. But are you seeing extra precautions taken?
I think, one of the Sierra Club positions is really about improving access to parks. And so we're delighted that lots of people are getting out and going to the parks. But I think there are some strategies to find different places so we don't overwear some of our really popular spots like Devil's Lake. So within, 10 minutes drive of Devil's Lake, there are a variety of hikes that you could be taking and probably be socially distanced from people and have a beautiful hike in the Baraboo Hills. So I think probably asking people, once you've been to Devil's Lake, try looking at some other places. And there's some great old school resources. There's some hiking books that Bob Crawford wrote about walking trails of southern Wisconsin, and I'm sure if you don't have a copy, you can always find that in the library. And the other resource that I use, and I'm sure this works up north too, is the Wisconsin Recreation Atlas by National Geographic, and it just shows all the different properties that people could be checking out. And I got to say that my husband and I are kind of having a contest to try and find new places within an hour's drive of Madison, where we live, where we are hiking and enjoying beautiful places and not seeing a lot of people.
Talking to Liz Wessel from the Sierra Club here in Wisconsin and Peter Nordgren with the North Country Trail Association in northern Wisconsin, looking at increased usage of our hiking trails in the state and some concerns, you know, making sure we don't overuse them, that we take good care of them. Peter, for people who aren't maybe experienced hikers, what would you suggest to them to, you know, enjoy hiking in as low impact a way as possible so they're keeping the trail in good shape for everybody else?
Well, a number of the national hiking organizations came together and created a website called Recreate Responsibly, and I think that's a nice guide. It suggests such things as, you know, maintaining space, being prepared to wear a mask if you get near other people, planning ahead. That's always a good rule when you're going outdoors. You know, choosing a route that is a good match for your capabilities. Explore locally, just as Liz has suggested. And, of course, using leave-no-trace practices, making sure whatever you bring with you, you take away and leave only footprints and make those lightly.
And, Liz, let's talk about the impact of, I guess, cumulative use. And my brain, I'll admit, has had that thought sometimes. If I'm on a trail and there's a nice little stream down there, and my brain thinks, oh, you know, one person walking down there going off the trail isn't going to have that much impact. But then the smarter part of my brain saying, yeah, one person and then five more people today and five every day, that starts to do some damage, right?
Yeah, it does. And so, I mean, one of the other practices I think that's in Leave No Trace as well and some of the other resources that were just cited is, you know, try and not get off trail. Stay on the trail. The trails are maintained, and that's why they're there. And we're trying to protect all the areas that are around them. They're there for you to enjoy. And I you know, my husband and I, when we go, we have these conversations. Treat the park the way you want to find it. Treat that trail the way you want to find it. So don't leave it. Like we talk about a banana peel. If you leave that behind, you know, sure, it's biodegradable, but it doesn't belong there, and it's not going to decompose by the time the next person comes down the trail or into the campsite that you're at. So think about, there's no one behind you cleaning up after you. So remember to bring your trash out, even if it's decomposable, because it just doesn't belong there, and the next person doesn't want to see it.
Peter, you do, I understand, some trail maintenance as a volunteer yourself. Have you seen signs that people aren't treating the trails well this year, or are we being pretty good?
Here it's pretty good, Rob. I haven't seen, you know, particular littering or a lot of damage. And again, it's because the North Country is a little more remote. But this is probably a good point to mention that the trail, particularly Wisconsin's two national scenic trails, but our other trails as well in the state, are largely maintained and built by volunteers. In our case, the National Park Service oversees the North Country and the Ice Age, and they provide us plans and they provide us tools, but it's up to volunteers to keep the trail in good shape. And anybody can be a volunteer, even when you're hiking, if you want to, you know, carefully move down branches or things like that, that's certainly appreciated. But you could also join your local trail chapter and get more involved if you wanted to, and that's very easy to do.
And I'm going to guess, Peter, you're always looking for more volunteers?
We always need new volunteers. You know, both the North Country and the Ice Age are works in progress. Within the state, they're both about half done. And so I like to say that this is a place where you can build your own national park. You can build a piece of a national park with your hands right in northern Wisconsin or in other parts of the state with the Ice Age.
And Liz, in a more densely populated place like South Central Wisconsin, people might think, oh, somebody else has got it. They're taking care of it. Is there a need for volunteers in that part of the state too?
Absolutely. Almost every park has a friends group, just like the trails do. And we have the Ice Age Trail winding through our area as well. So I would say people should definitely look to that. And I also would encourage people to to get involved in local park planning. Not only do we have great parks now, but get involved in your county planning. And we could always use more parks, but also we need that money to help maintain and protect the parks that we've got. You know, they all need some maintenance and things like that. So, and that also goes to things like the Ice Age Trail and the North Country Trail. So get involved in park planning. And right now, up north, 15 county, or I think all the counties, 29 counties are going through park planning. And that's an opportunity for you, if you're up in the northern counties, to get involved in saying what's important and what can be done for the parks up there.
Just a quick question for each of you before we wrap up. Want to hear one of your favorite things about getting out and hiking during the fall season in Wisconsin, which is well and truly upon us. Peter, why don't you start?
Well, for me, it's just breathing the fresh air and smelling that smell of fall, getting, you know, the sense that you are surrounded by nature and sort of seeing your place in the larger community.
That sounds great. And Liz, how about you?
Yeah, we just went out this past weekend to Wildcat Mountain State Park. And I was so inspired by the leaves, watching the leaves fall and hearing them. Wanted to take some video shots. I didn't, but did take some beautiful pictures. I think it's a really picturesque time in Wisconsin, and you can really appreciate the landscape as a whole.
Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Peter, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking to Liz Wessel, chair of the Sierra Club Four Lakes Group in South Central Wisconsin, and Peter Nordgren of Cornucopia is a longtime volunteer with the North Country Trail Association in northern Wisconsin. They both joined us to talk about an increase of traffic on the state's trails. Coming up, we talk to a citizen scientist about Wisconsin's butterflies and why it's important to keep tabs on Wisconsin's wildlife. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll catch up on the chaotic presidential debate and our weekly look at the week in Washington. First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources honored a number of citizen scientists recently for their work monitoring the state's natural resources. They've spent thousands of hours tracking dragonflies, birds, bees, snakes, wetlands, and more, efforts that the department says have been crucial to its knowledge base. We'll talk now to the winner of the department's Lifetime Achievement Award for keeping an eye on the state's wildlife, in particular butterflies. If you are a citizen scientist yourself, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in a wildlife tracking program here in the state or elsewhere, for that matter? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Reese is a longtime citizen scientist who created the Wisconsin Butterflies website. It tracks their varieties and their whereabouts. He's the winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award for citizen-based monitoring from the Wisconsin DNR. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be here, Rob.
Well, you've done a lot of different things. It's not just butterflies when it comes to monitoring wildlife. What got you started? I mean, a lot of people like going out and looking, maybe taking pictures. What made you take it a step further?
Well, you know, I've been interested in nature for a long time. I started, you know, getting interested in eating natural foods and wild foods. And so I did a lot of that, and that got me interested in botany. And I went, and I do have a master's degree in botany. So I've been really interested in it. But in terms of my vocation, I ended up becoming a high school math teacher and a librarian. And so I've always been interested in trying to help people learn. And so as part of that whole thing, I've become very interested in helping people learn about the things that I really like and enjoy. So butterflies were the first thing that I had Cub Scout kids that when I lived in Moshira County, they found three species of butterflies that I've never seen in Moshira County in the 30-some years that I lived there. So it was a lot of fun seeing what their interests could be and how excited they got. And it just encouraged me to continue that. And when I got back into that, when I got to be about 50 years old, I jumped into butterflies completely. So during my retirement, though, I also started trying to decide what I wanted to do to fill my time, and I got involved with a Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And so that was a lot of fun. I got to go around the state with my partner, William Mueller, and we did over 50 presentations trying to encourage people to do some bird atlasing and help us with that project.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the role of citizen scientists. The DNR, they have people out in the field as much as they can. How much do we rely on, I guess, everyday people to help monitor our wildlife in the state?
If it wasn't for the everyday people that help us do things, I mean, I say us, but you know, I consider myself a scientist, but you know, my butterfly stuff, you know, if I tried to do that all myself, it would have been impossible. Even now, I feel like the more I know, the less I actually know, because there's so many new things that I'm learning about that I don't really quite understand. And so that's the same with all kinds of science. You know, things are changing all the time. The habitat is changing, all those things. And if it wasn't for people helping to gather data and see what's occurring in those spots where no one else can really get to, it's really beneficial.
Now, you said butterfly stuff. Now, that's a pretty modest way to put this. I'm looking at the butterfly website that you have put together in collaboration, as you mentioned, with the help of other citizen scientists. Talk us through this thing. It's got so much. There's butterflies I didn't know existed in here. Lots of pictures to help us ID them and descriptions. Give us a sense of the scope of information you've got here.
Well, the thing that's really, well, you know, first of all, I want to thank my son, David, who designed and made this for me. And if it wasn't for him, I probably, you know, wouldn't have been able to have the success that I have. So I want to make sure that I do that. But one of the things we did was we did a sightings page. And so I have been the moderator for the North American Butterfly Association sightings page since 2001. And so when I started doing that, you know, I thought, wow, we should have one for Wisconsin. And I tried to make my own website, and my son decided to just make one for me. So we got that going, but we did the sightings page starting in like 2006. And with that, we gather all that information on the distribution of the butterflies throughout the state by giving us maps of where they've been seen and where they've been photographed or recorded. We also have a timeline of when those species are in flight. So you can check that. And all that data comes from just the sightings pages and the data that they submit. So it's a really useful thing to have that to see what's going on. So
people can see that at wisconsinbutterflies.org. We're talking with Mike Reese, co-creator of wisconsinbutterflies.org. He just won a Lifetime Achievement Award for his work in citizen science here in Wisconsin. Let's bring out a caller. Tucker is with us in Madison. Tucker, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I work in a nature preserve about 30 minutes north of Madison called Goose Pond, and we recently actually just had some monarch tagging events where we caught with nets and tagged monarchs. And it was a really fun time, and a lot of different people came out there, and so I just wanted to plug the events that Goose Pond in Arlington has for wildlife monitoring. I don't know how many there will be yet this season, but in future seasons for sure.
Tucker, thanks a lot for the call. So people can participate just by taking pictures in their own backyard and sharing them, but it sounds like there are also events we can get into, Mike.
Yes, certainly. There's especially like a lot of different nature centers. Goose Pond has been doing that tagging for quite a few years, and they really tagged quite a few monarchs in the short time they've been doing that. So obviously another important thing.
Now, I want to, Mike, I can spot a monarch butterfly. That's the one I can identify. Do you have a favorite, maybe lesser known character in the butterfly world you want to take a minute to tell us about?
Rob, whenever I talk to people about this, I say, well, the butterfly that's my favorite is the one I'm looking at right now. So, you know, there's a species called a fiery skipper. That's really, it is my favorite by far. I get so excited when I see it. It's a southern species. It's a little small butterfly, and yet it migrates throughout the state. There are many years when it makes it up to Lake Superior. So, you know, it's a small butterfly. If it makes it to Wisconsin some years, it might not. If we have a really cold year. This year, they're in the southern half of the state, and there's a lot of them at Olbrich Gardens, for example, in Madison. I had over 40 there a couple weeks ago. So it's definitely one of my favorites.
In our last minute or so, Mike, how would you encourage other people to get involved in wildlife monitoring?
Well, you have to have some interest in the subject that you're going to work on, but I think it's better just to jump in. I mean, that's what I did with a breeding bird atlas. I didn't know a lot of people, but you know, the people that I did meet, I enjoyed being around, and so I just jumped right in. And my goal then was, my motto was, retirement is for the birds. So I just jumped back in. I mean, if you really are going to become involved, you know, that's the way you have to do it. You have to just jump right in.
Mike, congratulations on the award, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Mike Reese is the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award for Citizen-Based Monitoring for the Wisconsin DNR. He's the creator of the Wisconsin Butterflies website, along with his son, which tracks their varieties and whereabouts. We talked to Mike about his work as a citizen scientist and what makes Wisconsin's wildlife so fascinating to track. Coming up after the news, coronavirus case numbers are climbing again in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. We'll talk to a Washington reporter for a national perspective as we look at some of the top political stories for the week. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up today at 6, when asked about taxes, polls suggest most Americans think paying your fair share is part of being a good citizen. But what is fair, and why is it so hard to simplify the tax code? Jen White finds out and shares your stories today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the first presidential debate took place last night in Cleveland. For 90 minutes with no breaks or commercials, President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee former Vice President Joe Biden responded to half a dozen or so topics and questions from Fox News Sunday anchor Chris Wallace. In case you missed it, here's a bit of what much of the evening sounded like, with Wallace attempting to direct a question at Trump.
Over the last 4 years, you have promised to repeal and replace Obamacare, but you have never in these 4 years come up with a plan, a comprehensive plan to replace Obamacare.
Of course I have.
Well,
I got rid of the individual mandate. Excuse me. I got rid of the individual mandate, which was a big chunk of
Obamacare.
That is absolutely a big thing. That was the worst part of Obamacare. Chris, that was the worst part of Obamacare.
Let me ask my question.
Well, I'll ask Joe. The individual mandate was the most unpopular aspect of Obamacare. I got rid of it.
I'd like you
to. And we will protect people with pre-existing
conditions. I'm the moderator of this debate. And I would like you to let me ask my question, and then you can answer.
Go ahead.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to the event last night? What were your reactions and thoughts? Do you think there was a clear winner if you think about debates in that way? Did either candidate win you over if you were one of the few undecided voters leading up to the event? Call 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more debates, the remaining scheduled two? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. It's the week in Washington. We'll look at a couple of the top stories in national political news, including that debate. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me again.
So my first question, Reid, is can we talk about last night's debate in the way that we in the media usually talk about presidential debates? This one was different.
Well, you know, we could just spend the next 10 minutes talking over each other if
Let's
you wanted
do it.
To sort of reimagine what last night really was. This debate last night is making people rethink the basic ground rules of how a debate operates. We've even heard the suggestion from the Commission on Presidential Debates today that they're going to consider new ways to control the two candidates. And to me, that sounds like, you know, giving the moderator a button to shut off one of their mics or something, which would be absolutely unprecedented. I mean, I'm old enough. I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough to remember when Al Gore sighing loudly was seen as a huge sign of disrespect. And it was a multi-day story after one of his debates with George W. Bush. This is another level altogether. I mean, you had one candidate call the sitting president of the United States of America a fool and a clown, and then told him to shut up at one point. And that wasn't even the most out of control moment of the entire debate. So, yeah, if there were norms and guardrails before, they have now been fully cast aside.
So what do you take away from the event last night?
So I think President Trump missed an opportunity to change the race. Look, we can see from the surveys, whether it's the national polls or the surveys in Wisconsin or any of the other prime swing states, that President Trump is behind. He's losing this race by a not insubstantial margin in a lot of states. So he needed to use a moment when tens of millions, if not 100 million people, were tuning in to this debate to really change the focus of the contest, make this more about Joe Biden, and make this sort of hit the reset button. He didn't do that last night. He made the contest about himself. He sort of played to his base. I mean, there were times when you would have to be pretty steeped into the sort of Fox News, Breitbart worldview of right-wing media to understand what he was talking about with crooked Hillary and the emails and the hoax and all this stuff. I didn't see a lot of effort to expand the base, to change the trajectory of this race. And therefore, with four of these debates on tap, three presidentials and a vice presidential, you know, President Trump missed one of the opportunities that he had to change the trajectory of the race. On the other hand, Joe Biden had a moment that, like, showed why Democrats were enthusiastic about, like, showed the upside of Joe Biden. He looked into the camera. He spoke to the American people. At one point, he said something like, how many of you woke up this morning with an empty seat at your table because somebody had died of COVID-19? That sort of empathy and connecting with people has always been Joe Biden's strong suit, and he showed it at a moment when it proved a real contrast with President Trump.
Talking to Reid Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. We'll focus for a good chunk of the conversation on the presidential debate last night, and you can join in with your reactions, 800-642-1234, either to one of the candidates, both of them, to the debate itself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to Jeffrey with us now in De Pere. Jeffrey, hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I hope I don't really mess this up, but last night I did not watch the whole debate. I listened to it on captions through the cable television, and it was absolutely ridiculous, like a bully beating down another little kid tail stealing his lunch money. And the darndest thing is that we as American citizens over 244 years have allowed this to happen, and this isn't the first time. And it probably won't be the last time.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. A lot of general expressions of disappointment and some shamefacedness from Americans on this. Do you think that Jeffrey's is a common reaction, Reid?
Yeah, I do. Granted, my worldview last night was through a combination of watching it on TV and checking my Twitter feed. But there were a lot of people who, respected columnist types who were starting to talk about not having the next couple of debates. And that's not something that you hear from people who spend their time covering sort of civic life in America. I think the other two debates and the vice presidential debate are going to continue. I think it's in each candidate's interest for them to continue. But the fact that people were questioning that, that says something about the level of discourse that we've seen. Now, it's not as if we should have expected a modern Lincoln Douglas debate from two candidates who very obviously despise each other at the deepest personal levels. But I suppose we could have hoped for better.
Thanks for that call, Jeffrey. Go to Deb now in Stevens Point. Deb, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was very disappointed with the way the debate went last night and equated our President Trump, his ability to allow others to speak at the conversation between two third graders fighting over something. And I feel I'm a former speech pathologist, and I feel anyone who had someone heckling verbally from the side would interfere with another's ability to think and get their thoughts together. I've already heard comments of Joe Biden possibly having Alzheimer's or dementia, and I think that that's totally unfair after last night's performance by our leader.
Deb, thanks for the call. And some people have talked about the run-up and the Trump campaign's framing of Joe Biden questioning, as Deb suggested, some people were his mental ability. And some people are warning that might be a trap, that then all Joe Biden had to do was show up and, be coherent, and that might defeat that expectation. What do you make of that expectation game?
Yeah, the expectation game was played terribly by the Trump campaign. I mean, for months, they've been questioning Joe Biden's mental acuity. They have not apparently paid attention to his two turns on the national debate stage, one against Sarah Palin, one against Paul Ryan back in 2012. And the fact that he just went through 11, maybe 12 primary debates, including the last one where he was one-on-one with Bernie Sanders, who's no weak debater himself. I talked to a couple of debating experts from colleges around the country last week, and one of them said to me, all Biden has to do is show up and say, noun, subject, verb, and he's cleared the bar that the Trump campaign has set for him. It was very clear that Donald Trump was, in fact, trying to rattle Vice President Biden, as Deb brought up, especially as he brought up Hunter Biden and the business relationships that Hunter Biden has built across the world. I was struck, though, by the way that Joe Biden not only avoided getting angry. I mean, the one time he showed sort of a flash of anger was when his other son, Beau Biden, the late Beau Biden, came up. But aside from that, he turned a very brutally personal attack on Hunter Biden and his struggles with drug addiction back to that empathy card that Biden is so good at playing. He talked about the fact that Hunter Biden had struggled with a drug addiction just like so many other Americans. And I thought that was a real moment when he took what could have been a gut punch that would have completely thrown him off his game and showed that, it benefits somebody to have been on a national debate stage under these Klieg lights several times before.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, mainly the debate. We'll touch on another issue or two toward the end of the conversation, including the latest on COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to last night's debate. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's the week in Washington. We continue our talk with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, taking your calls right now on yesterday's debate at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us now in Stevens Point. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Lori?
Well, I did watch the debate, the whole debate, the entire debate survived. I was disappointed, but not surprised. I'm not surprised because the president behaved the same way when he was debating with Hillary, when he was debating in the primary with the Republicans back in 2015 and 16. So I'm not surprised at his behavior. I was glad that Biden maintained some composure the best that he could with all the ranting. But I wanted to say something. I'm a veteran. I'm over 50. And I served under a president that I did not vote for. And I think the patriotism and the division in the country is quite disappointing. And I was hopeful for Trump when he was elected. I was hopeful that he would recognize the enormity of the position that he holds and really would be a uniter. And the fact that he did not denounce the hate groups, the Proud Boys, was extremely disappointing. That is a gut punch. And anybody who thinks that that's great, or that, hey, he's telling it like it is, or he's being a tough guy, look around you. If you don't support that, I just feel like you don't support the Constitution and what this what this country stands for.
Thanks a lot for the call, Lori Reed. A lot there. Where do you want to go with it?
Well, I'm glad that Lori survived. Sorry, that made me chuckle a little bit, the way she put that. But yeah, that was one of the moments that stood out to me the most. You know, President Trump does not like, has never been good at distancing himself from people who back him, no matter if they are, simply objectionable or if they espouse views that truly run counter to sort of what we think of as modern America, including white supremacist groups and anti-Semitic groups like the Proud Boys. He cleaned it up a little bit this morning, in which, as he was on his way to Marine One to take off for a campaign rally, he said that he didn't really know who the Proud Boys were, and that's all that mattered, and of course tried to turn it back on Joe Biden and Antifa. But this is something that is a bit of a pattern with President Trump. It doesn't matter who is praising him. So long as it's praise, he's going to accept it.
Thanks for calling in, Lori. Let's go to Rose now in Menominee Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi there. I listened to the whole thing. It was horrible. I would ask or propose for the next two debates that they have one evening with just Joe Biden and a town hall format, and the following debate night have Trump and a town hall format. It's very clear that these two are not going to be able to have a productive dialogue between the two of them. The moderator had almost no control over the situation. I think we would learn a lot more, and I think it would be more fair to the candidates to just have them be separate.
Thanks for the call. Reed, we have seen some of these town hall style things with either of the candidates. I think the next debate is supposed to be a town hall format. Is it worth thinking about a change of format at this late stage in the game?
Well, I don't think you're going to get the two campaigns to agree on that. I mean, these debates are set months in advance. People, the two sides hammer out every possible agreement that they could, from how far away the two are going to be to how they sit or stand, whether or not they're allowed notes. All these little details are to be negotiated for months in advance. So I doubt that you'd see something like that. And frankly, I think it behooves both of the campaigns to stick with the plan that they have. And we see Joe Biden is able to leverage his skills as a debater, his experience on the debate stage, to contrast himself with what people see in President Trump. And on the other hand, President Trump needs that one-on-one. He needs to make the case that both that he deserves another 4 years and that Joe Biden does not deserve 4 years in the Oval Office. So it is in both sides' best interest to continue the formats that we have now. As we go into the future, though, I mean, I love that idea. We've seen, President Trump did a town hall meeting. I think it was on ABC a couple of weeks ago. Joe Biden did one on CNN a couple of weeks ago. In both cases, I like this idea of voters getting the chance to question their candidates. I think that should happen a lot more than it does. Now, a part of that reason it's not happening is because of the coronavirus. But another part is because the campaigns don't like that uncontrolled setting. And frankly, if we're electing a president, let's see how they act in uncontrolled settings.
Thanks a lot for all of your calls. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Reed Wilson is with us, national correspondent for The Hill in Washington. Reed, want to hit a couple other issues in just our last few minutes. I know you follow closely COVID-19, its progress at the state level, and unfortunately, I think your eyes are probably turning toward us here in Wisconsin right now. What are you watching from the national vantage point?
Yeah, I've been watching Wisconsin with sort of growing nervousness for the last couple of weeks. I mean, Wisconsin is becoming sort of a precursor to what we're likely to see in the rest of the country as more and more people stay indoors longer, as schools reopen, just as the weather turns colder. We've started to see the case counts rise. We've started to see the hospitalizations rise. I'm pretty worried about President Trump heading to Green Bay and La Crosse in the next couple of days, two counties that are in red zone counties. If you're going to the president's rallies, you know, please wear masks and take every possible step you can to stay safe. But, Wisconsin right now, I'm sorry to say, is becoming a sort of a precursor for what the rest of the country is likely to experience in just the next few months.
And what are you seeing at the national level? We're not seeing these daily briefings anymore. Does it seem like there's a priority from the Congress or the president with giving consistent messages on COVID, mask wearing and all that?
Well, so we're seeing consistent messages from most states and most governors who are offering this, the pretty consistent CDC message: wear a mask, stay 6 feet away from people when you can, and be as well ventilated as possible. We're not seeing the urgency from Congress. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin have been talking in the last few days about putting together a new package of stimulus measures, but we haven't seen any details. We haven't seen any plans on paper, and that all tells me that they are miles apart on any kind of reform package or stimulus package, which sort of boggles the mind a little bit. I mean, the economy is suffering. People are out of work, in substantial numbers, and a president is seeking reelection. You would think that he would just be adding zeros to whatever bill that the House Democrats would pass and then force it through the Senate just weeks before an election. That hasn't happened. And the reason for that, I'm not entirely certain. But the fact is, we are not anywhere close to having some kind of agreement on a real bill, a real stimulus package.
In our last minute and a half or so, one thing that is happening in the Senate, the confirmation efforts for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's nominee to fill the seat left open by the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Where is this effort at right now, Reid?
So Judge Barrett is taking meetings with senators, mostly Republican senators at the moment. I haven't seen any Democrats who have agreed to sit down with her. The Democrats are treating Judge Barrett just as the Republicans did Judge Merrick Garland about 4 years ago, a little more than 4 years ago now. When the Republicans refused to meet with him, refused to hold hearings or hold a vote, the difference is that Republicans are now still the majority, of course, and therefore the Democrats not meeting with Judge Barrett isn't going to have the same impact. She is likely to come up for confirmation hearings. She's likely to come up for a vote. And I think Republicans are aiming to force through a confirmation vote before Election Day rather than after.
And briefly, Reid, so much going on. What are you watching for over the next week?
Well, I'm going to be watching the vice presidential debate coming up next. It's going to be a fascinating clash of two very experienced public presenters, if you will. Vice President Mike Pence, a former radio host, Senator Kamala Harris, a former prosecutor, somebody who knows how to prosecute a case. That will be a much more respectful debate than what we saw last night, but it could be even more brutal as the two campaigns go after Vice President Biden and President Trump.
Reid, thanks again for joining us today.
You got it. Thanks for having me again.
Reid Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. We talked to him today for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics and focused on last night's first presidential debate. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the pandemic is a tough time to be a parent for a lot of reasons. A mental health expert joins us to share advice to help parents keep up their mental and emotional well-being. You can join in with the concerns you've encountered along the way, and maybe, if you're a parent, your advice for other parents, for kids of all ages. Also, this election is likely to see more mail-in votes than usual, and the president and others have attacked the process. We'll look at the challenges to the legitimacy of this year's presidential outcome. And environmental and health advocate Erin Brockovich is with us. She's worried about water quality in the United States. In her new book, she says it's up to everyday Americans to protect it. Join the conversation, and you can join in with concerns about water quality in your part of the state or wherever you are. You can join the conversation with author Erin Brockovich. All that and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. We just had Reed Wilson bring us some of the latest news in national politics. And thanks to his Twitter feed, we found out about some of the latest news in weird animal stories. Here's one of them that he had posted. A zoo in England had to split up a group of gray parrots because of their not safe for work language. As reported by the Associated Press, the five parrots named Billy, Eric, Tyson, Jade, and Elsie were part of the Lincolnshire Wildlife Center's colony of 200 gray parrots. Somewhere along the way, these five developed a speaking habit full of swear words. And they weren't shy about it in front of the visitors. In the interest of not exposing kids to all the strong language, the five were split up into different parts of the colony. Apparently, on their own, they didn't swear quite so much, but when they hung out together, they egged each other on into displays of foul language. Sounds a lot like my junior high years. Lovely plumage, though. On the upside, the zookeepers say they hadn't gotten a lot of complaints. Many of their visitors actually found these swearing parrots to be kind of entertaining. It's bird news you can use. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.